Hello and welcome to Background Briefing, available 24/7 at backgroundbriefing.org. I'm Ian Masters, and today we'll examine a number of stories and issues in the news. We'll begin with President Trump's denial in a tweet today claiming he has no financial interest in Saudi Arabia or Russia, for that matter, which flies in the face of the many statements he made on the campaign trail boasting about how much money he was making out of the Saudis and that he liked them very much. Carolyn Kenny, a senior policy analyst for national security and international policy at the Center for American Progress, joins us to discuss her new report, Trump's Conflicts of Interest in Saudi Arabia, and the large number of Saudi-related LLCs Trump listed in his May 2016 financial disclosure. We'll go back to Trump's earlier dealings with Saudi Prince Alawid bin Talal, who gave Trump an infusion of desperately needed cash when he bought Trump's yacht in 1991 after he was forced to surrender it to creditors, and then again in 1995 when lenders made him sell the Plaza Hotel. Talal bought the Plaza for less than Trump paid for it years earlier. It seems to be hardly a coincidence that Prince Alawid bin Talal, who Trump took frequent jabs at on Twitter, was one of the names on the classified U.S. intelligence list of critics of the Saudi crown prince that Jared Kushner is reported to have given to MBS. And as one of the richest Saudis, Alawid bin Talal was arrested by MBS, tortured, and forced to give over a considerable chunk of his fortune to Jared and Trump's friend MBS, who now stands accused of murdering and butchering a Saudi-American journalist with the Washington Post. Then we'll examine the possibility that Turkey's President Erdogan is angling for a big payoff from the Saudis to make this embarrassing matter go away, or that he is bluffing and does not have the evidence of the murder and dismemberment of Khashoggi that has been leaked to the press in tantalizing snippets for the last week. Henri Barkey, who served as a member of the State Department's policy planning staff and is the author of Reluctant Neighbor, Turkey's Role in the Middle East, joins us to discuss his hunch that Erdogan does not have the evidence the Turks have promised. Then finally, we'll speak with Aaron Stein, a resident senior fellow at the Atlantic Council's Rafif Hariri Center for the Middle East, an expert on Turkey. He joins us to discuss the extent to which President Trump is orchestrating the Saudi denial and cover-up following Trump's announcement today that MBS told him in a phone call that he, quote, totally denied any knowledge of what happened to Khashoggi and that the Crown Prince wants, quote, a full and complete investigation into this matter. We'll assess what kind of a deal Secretary of State Pompeo is making as he heads to Turkey tomorrow after talks with the Saudi leadership. And joining us now is Carolyn Kenny, who is a senior policy analyst for national security and international policy at the Center for American Progress, working on the Sustainable Security and Peacebuilding Initiative. Previously, she worked with the International Foundation for Electoral Systems, the International Crisis Group, and Human Rights Watch. And she has a new report at the Center for American Progress, Trump's Conflicts of Interest in Saudi Arabia. Welcome to Background Briefing, Carolyn Kenny.
Great. Thank you so much.
So the broad issue here seems to be that there's a kind of almost a fraternity of kleptocrats, criminals who are heads of state. MBS, of course, the Saudi crown prince, who seems to be have authored this grisly assassination. He just bought a $500 million yacht. He spent $300 million on a chateau in France, spent $500 million on a Leonardo da Vinci that may be a fake. That's a lot of money for a guy on a government salary, isn't it?
Yeah, I would certainly say so.
So, and then you've got Erdogan and his family, they're kleptocrats, and then, of course, you've got Putin, who Khashoggi, the guy that was murdered, the Washington Post reporter, what apparently got under MBS's skin was that Khashoggi had likened him to Putin. So do you see this as a broader kind of landscape that we're facing almost globally, whether democratic regimes or any kind of vaguely democratic regime is going to survive this kind of growth of criminality? And it seems like Donald Trump, his best friends are these criminals, for God's sake.
Yeah, I mean, I would definitely agree. Trump has certainly shown a disturbing preference for authoritarian and kleptocratic leaders. you know, even when provided definitive evidence of their involvement in egregious human rights violations or other crimes. In this instance with Khashoggi, it's difficult to say with certainty whether or not his response to the disappearance is just another instance of his complete disregard for these issues, human rights, international law, corruption, or if his inaction is related to his own financial interests. So, of course, neither of these options are mutually exclusive.
So let's talk about President Trump, of course, said that he doesn't have any financial dealings with Saudi Arabia, but on television they've been playing fairly recent film clips of him on the stump in the 2016 elections, talking about how great his dealings with the Saudis are and how much money he gets from them, and, you know, you can't turn that kind of money down, etc. So this is obviously a fundamental problem dealing with Trump, because he literally will say anything. An awful lot of people in this country believe it, no matter how absurd and how much it contradicts what he'd said a year or even 10 minutes ago. So let's walk through some of the stuff that it looks as though the relationship with Saudi money goes back quite a bit. And in the piece that you've written, Trump's conflicts of interest in Saudi Arabia, let's begin in 1991 with Prince Alawid bin Talal, who, by the way, Khashoggi worked for him, and Alawid Talal was one of the people that MBS arrested, took to the Ritz-Carlton, tortured, shook him down, and confiscated quite a chunk of his multi-billion-dollar fortune. So let's start with Alawid bin Talal's purchase of Trump's yacht, Trump Princess.
Sure. Well, as you correctly noted, contrary to Trump's tweet claiming he has no financial interests in Saudi Arabia, he certainly had a long history of financial dealings with the country dating back to at least the 1990s, when he was billed out twice by the Saudi prince at moments when he was desperately in need of cash. So like you mentioned, in 1991, Talal purchased Trump's yacht after he was forced to surrender it to creditors because he was $900 million in debt. And again, in 1995, Talal purchased the Plaza Hotel in New York City for $325 million after Trump's lenders pressured him to sell it. And as you mentioned, these clips, you know, during the campaign, the Trump Organization formed companies seemingly related to doing business in Saudi Arabia. And on the same day some of these were incorporated, at a rally in Alabama, Trump stated that he gets along with Saudi Arabia because they buy apartments from him, essentially making it clear the link between Saudi money flowing to his businesses and his approval of the kingdom. And then since the election, we have the Saudi government continuing to pour money into Trump properties. They were the first publicly reported foreign government to make a payment to a Trump business following Trump's election to the tune of $270,000. And as recently reported by the Washington Post, the Saudis boosted Trump's hotels in New York and Chicago after both had reported losses since 2016. And while the Trump Organization has claimed it would transfer any profits from foreign governments to the Treasury Department, it's not at all clear that this has happened. It's clear that Saudi money has flowed into the Trump Organization and Trump's coffers since well before he was elected and through his presidency.
And just specifically, Trump tweeted out today, "For the record, I have no financial interest in Saudi Arabia or Russia for that matter. Any suggestion that I have is just more fake news, of which there is plenty." Well, we know that there's an awful lot of connections to Russia and that a lot of Russian gangsters, starting as early as 1985, laundered money, largely stolen from the Communist Party coffers, into Trump properties. And the trail of money laundering with Trump is being looked at by Mueller. Is it possible that the Saudi Arabia story has sort of gone a little under the radar until this horrible murder and dismemberment of Khashoggi sort of brought it back into attention? Because I've heard suggestions for some time now that the other shoe to drop is not so much Trump's, how much the Russians may have financed him and propped him up and turned this fake billionaire into a kind of propped up billionaire, that there may be just as much skeletons in the closet vis-a-vis Saudi Arabia in terms of both business dealings and perhaps helping fund his election.
I mean, I'm certain that this is something that, you know, is being looked at. I mean, Trump himself stated that Saudi money was flowing into his businesses. You know, he said, quote, "They spend $40 million, $50 million. Am I supposed to dislike them? I like them very much." So it's clear that money has flown from Saudis to Trump. And, you know, there are other instances of interesting sequences of events, especially when you look at the $110 billion arms deal between the U.S. and Saudi Arabia, which was negotiated by Trump's son-in-law, Jared Kushner, following the finalization of this arms deal ahead of Trump's first official visit as president to Saudi Arabia, the kingdom announced that it would invest $20 billion in an infrastructure fund managed by Blackstone Group, which is a company that's loaned over $400 million to finance deals by the Kushner Company and whose co-founder and CEO accompanied Trump on this trip and served as the head of his business advisory council and benefited from this announcement with roughly $500 million in net worth after it was announced. So it's difficult to look at that series of events as well and the individuals involved not be concerned about conflicts of interest related to Saudi Arabia. And certainly there are, you know, others as well.
And again, I'm speaking with Carolyn Kenny, who's a senior policy analyst for National Security and International Policy at the Center for American Progress, working on the Sustainable Security and Peacebuilding Initiative. And previously, she worked with the International Foundation for Electoral Systems, the International Crisis Group, and Human Rights Watch. And she has a new report at the Center for American Progress, Trump's Conflicts of Interest in Saudi Arabia. And as I'm sure you know, Carolyn, there's been press reports about the possibility that Jared Kushner leaked top-secret information that he got via his security clearance to his best buddy, MBS, tipped him off about who the Saudi dissidents were amongst the royal family, even not so much dissidents, but even just simply critics of his. And that led to the arrest of a number of these wealthy Saudis, princes, along with Alawid bin Talal, who we talked about earlier, where they were held captive in the Ritz-Carlton Hotel, the very site of the new upcoming Davos in the Desert, number two, which many are boycotting, except, as far as we know, the Secretary of Treasury has not boycotted it, nor has Fox Business, but just about everybody else has. So what do you make of that possibility? Because if that's the case, and if there's a quid pro quo going on here between the Trump family and the Salman family, the part of the royal family, this is what I find troubling. We're not dealing with a situation that you normally have in geopolitics, which is country-to-country relationships. This is starting to smack of family-to-family relationships.
Certainly. I mean, as a result of the way that Trump and his family, including Kushner, have blurred the lines between their business and the administration, you know, it's very difficult for any of these things to not be seen as, you know, parts of the presidency and therefore avenues for currying favor. And I think that this is certainly, you know, a very disturbing development in our government and not good at all.
And what about the possibility that not just that Kushner gave his friend MBS a list of the princes that weren't happy with him, because, you know, it was largely because of Trump's and Jared's intervention that he was the deputy crown prince, MBS, and he was promoted over the crown prince, Mohammed bin Nayef, who is very popular amongst the sort of Washington establishment, the State Department, Defense Department, and the CIA. And the appearance and evidence appears to be that the White House was the ones that promoted him, in effect. So we know that, for example, on December the 10th of 2016, right after Trump was elected, that Jared Kushner had a secret meeting with the Russian ambassador, Sergei Kislyak, and the head of the bank that's referred to as Putin's slush fund. And at this meeting, Kushner asked for two things. He asked for a secret back channel between the Kremlin and Trump. And two, he asked for $500 million, $500 million to bail out a property vanity purchase he made on 666 Fifth Avenue to impress Ivanka when he was courting her. And it's been underwater ever since. So if he did that to the Russians, shook them down for $500 million, is it possible that some of these generous deals that he's made with the Saudis, helping MBS get rid of his enemies or perceived enemies, do you think there's a possibility that some money is exchanged hands?
I mean, I think almost certainly there's a possibility. I think that, you know, they've given every indication that they can be swayed, you know, given the right benefits. So I think that it's entirely possible that that could have happened. You know, again, we don't know for certain, and none of this stuff is, they're not very transparent about all of the things that they do, and they're not transparent about their finances, as, you know, many reports have shown. And I think that that just makes it even more concerning. And it makes it, you know, every American deserves to know if their president or his advisors are putting their own self-enrichment ahead of our national security and national interests. And unfortunately, Trump and his family have not divested from their businesses. They're still benefiting from them. So there's no way to separate the two definitively.
So what are all of these LLCs that Trump set up under the title of DT Jeddah? Jeddah being, of course, one of the holy city where the important shrines are in Islam, in Mecca and Medina, Jeddah being the city nearby on the coast on the Red Sea. So you've listed them in your article. What's the story with all of these LLCs?
You know, I don't think that the story ever came out. They, you know, established the LLCs, and then according to their, you know, own filings, they said that they were closed in the end of 2016. I don't think that they ever went anywhere. And, you know, Trump has repeatedly said he will have no new foreign deals while in office. So I think that this is not something that is moving at this moment. But again, you know, if he's not going to be president for life, there's no way to know. He will be benefiting from his presidency long after it's over. So there's no way to know if they'll be opened in the future. You know, the Trump Organization claims they won't, but...
But they were in a financial disclosure form in May of 2016, right?
Correct.
And he's listed them all. And there's quite a number of them. So there were vehicles, but we don't know what flowed through them and whether they're active.
Yeah, we don't know. And the limited amount of information Trump is given in these disclosure forms, you know, he claims that no money flowed through them. But again, this is like voluntary information he's given, and he hasn't released his tax forms. There's really no way to know any of this for certain.
So where do you think the American people come down on this? I mean, obviously there's this fascination with wealth, and that I think a lot of people, particularly working Americans, voted for Trump with a sort of sense that some of the gold may trickle down to them, the idea that you too can win the lottery. We've always had kind of aspirational politics in this country, but why do you think there is this fascination with wealth? And even if this guy isn't a real billionaire, he's a wannabe billionaire, nevertheless, he's advertised his wealth. He boasted about it on the campaign trail. How do you explain that disconnect, that all he's done since he's been in office and all the people he picked for his cabinet are all billionaires and just about, and they're all stealing the country blind, as is he, and they're stiffing the very people who voted for them and giving away massive tax breaks to the wealthiest of the wealthy. And now we learn today that even the Republicans like Mitch McConnell are alarmed at how the deficit is so huge now. Well, it's huge because of the so-called middle-class tax breaks, which actually all went to the super wealthy. And again, that's a perfect example of this fraud that's going on, this con. So I guess it's a long-winded way to ask, why do so many people in this country put up with this?
I mean, I wish I had the answer to that. I mean, as you point out, it's certainly clear that Trump is using the presidency to enrich himself, his family, his friends, and that's hugely problematic. His conflicts of interest are not only unethical and maybe even illegal and unconstitutional, they erode public trust in government and institutions and tarnish U.S. standing abroad, all of which can do untold damage. Like you mentioned, the deficit and all these things, like, I think we don't know, and it's not clear to me why people aren't bothered by this. And then on top of that, there's no way of knowing if he's ever acting in his own interest or the interest of the American people, whether that's in Saudi Arabia or anywhere else in the world, which does huge damage to the United States.
Well, on top of that, you've got this criminality that's going on, this fascination with despots being, you know, the only two people that he seems to defer to are MBS, and we know MBS, what he's just done, and we know what Putin's just done. In fact, they've both done something very similar. They've murdered dissidents on foreign soil as a signal to their own people to terrorize them into submission. These are the kind of people he keeps company with. He dismissed this victim out as not being an American citizen. He has obviously not displaying any moral qualms. He doesn't seem to care about this human rights abuse, this flagrant human rights abuse. And he's talking about how it's more important to sell arms to Saudi Arabia than it is to stand up for human rights.
Yeah, I mean, it's quite alarming. Obviously, American politicians have long ignored the Saudi government's wrongdoing, but many of them, including Lindsey Graham, seem to be taking a stand in this particular instance. And while they're doing that, Trump seems to be providing the Saudi government with an out by suggesting that rogue killers may have been responsible for Khashoggi's death, even though there's every indication that such an act would have required the approval of the crown prince. I mean, it's horrible, and to turn a blind eye to human rights violations like this is terrible and something that I think is quite unprecedented.
So just in closing, since we've only got a couple of weeks more to probably the most critical elections in modern American history, if Trump wins, if the Republicans win, there'll be more of this, more criminality, more erosion of American values and American democracy itself, an awful lot's at stake. Can you give us a sense that the better angels are going to emerge? The evidence is so overwhelming that this man is a disaster, and the people that he seems to admire, like Putin and MBS, this guy's an out-of-control little thug who's obviously a murderous psycho, and we know that Putin is the same. So I just fear for the fate of the country.
I mean, likewise, and I would hope, no matter what way the elections go, that Congress would be able to see these indications and, conduct some level of oversight over Trump's actions and try to root out some of this corruption and hold them accountable for these sorts of things. And I guess that's kind of the best we can hope for in the moment. But yeah, it's tough, and it's hard to feel positive about it.
Well, but we can't leave people on that note. We have to make sure people get they've got to get out and vote, for God's sake.
Yes, most definitely. If for nothing else than to get oversight over this administration.
Well, Carolyn Kenny, I thank you very much for joining us.
Yes, thank you very much for having me.
And again, I've been speaking with Carolyn Kenny, who's a senior policy analyst for national security and international policy at the Center for American Progress, working on the Sustainable Security and Peacebuilding Initiative. Previously, she worked with the International Foundation for Electoral Systems, the International Crisis Group, and Human Rights Watch. And she has a new report at the Center for American Progress, Trump's Conflicts of Interest in Saudi Arabia. We're going to take a brief station break and back examining the possibility that Turkey's President Erdogan is angling for a big payoff or is bluffing about the evidence he claims to have. Welcome back. I'm Ian Masters, and this is Background Briefing, available 24/7 at backgroundbriefing.org. And joining us now is Henri Barkey. He's a professor of international relations at Lehigh University and a senior fellow in Middle East Studies at the Council on Foreign Relations. He served as a member of the U.S. State Department's policy planning staff, primarily working on the Middle East, the Eastern Mediterranean, and intelligence. And he has authored, co-authored, and edited 5 books, among them Turkey's Kurdish Question with Graham Fuller and Reluctant Neighbor, Turkey's Role in the Middle East. Welcome to Background Briefing, Henri Barkey.
Thank you.
So, Henri, what are we to make of this extraordinary situation where you have Donald Trump, almost the president of the United States, almost coaching the Saudi Arabians to come up with a cover story? They apparently are going to deny that they did anything, that a rogue group, in fact, it was Trump himself that first floated the idea of a rogue group, and that they were going to say that Jamil Khashoggi, the Saudi American journalist, it was an interrogation that went wrong. Well, I don't know how you can explain an interrogation that went wrong if you chopped up the body and shipped out the body parts. But on top of that, you got Erdogan, who seems to be also, the Turkish leader, seems to be sort of playing a game here, leaking stuff, but not delivering the evidence. Is he angling for a big payoff from the Saudis?
Well, first of all, I mean, let's look at the facts as we know them. We know that Mr. Khashoggi has disappeared, right? We know at the beginning the Saudis said, we have nothing to do with it, he left the consulate, that's not our problem. And then, as evidence mounted, or I should say, when Mr. Khashoggi didn't show up anywhere, people started speculating that, yes, indeed, he must have been killed. And yesterday we had the news that the Saudis were going to admit that he essentially died during interrogation at the consulate in Istanbul. But then, today, they seem to have rescinded that, should we say, call it confession, acceptance. And the important thing is that what yesterday they were going to claim was that either the interrogation went wrong or that this interrogation was mounted by rogue elements within the security establishment of Saudi Arabia. Either way, it was an admission that he did die at the consulate. Now, that's all we are surmising. That's all we know. What we know today is that the Saudis are completely denying it again. And the president seems to be trying to back them up. We do not know anything beyond that. The Turks said that they had video and audio evidence. It turns out, I don't think they have it because they haven't shown it to anybody. They changed their story. And initially they said it was taken inside the consulate. Then they said it was being transmitted by Mr. Khashoggi's watch. And they are the ones who are saying that the body has been dismembered and shipped in parts back to Saudi Arabia. Again, we do not know if that's true. These are not facts in evidence. For all I know, maybe they did ship the body. Maybe the body was shipped in one big bag that was developed pouch. We don't know, right? But it is clear that there's a three-way game going on here between Saudi Arabia, Turkey, and the United States. The United States is trying to bolster the Saudis. The Turks are trying to extract concessions from both the United States and from Saudi Arabia. And the concessions are, I presume, some form of monetary gains from Saudi Arabia and political gains from the United States. You have to admit that this Khashoggi business has come at a very opportune time for the Turks because only a few days ago did they finally release Pastor Andrew Brunson, whom they had held for 2 years on spurious, ridiculous, made-up charges. And today, instead of talking about Brunson's experience in jail in Turkey, he has been pushed to the back pages. And all we're talking about is Khashoggi. So this, I think the Turks are playing this game of, yes, we have evidence and so on and so forth, because it also helps them to kind of define the narrative.
Well, it is puzzling that they don't release the damning evidence they have, but they have released, obviously, a video of the 15 Saudis that showed up on that one day, and that's highly suspicious, isn't it? And again today, the Turkish authorities are saying that the Saudi journalist was cut into pieces without, again, showing anything, having already claimed that they have audio and video. So at what point is Erdogan going to be forced to show up or shut up?
Well, my guess is that at the end of the day, there will be some kind of deal, a three-way deal, and he'll shut up. But here's the other thing. They did show the pictures of the 15, but they also showed a picture of one of the 15 who supposedly was coming in and going through passport control. It turns out that picture was from 2013, and the guy was coming in with his wife, who was right behind him. So even there's a little bit of, shall we say, suspicion as to whether or not all that information is correct. I personally, I do think that Mr. Khashoggi died at the consulate. I don't know if he was necessarily killed in cold blood or he had a heart attack or he was given some kind of sedative that he reacted badly to. I have no idea. There's no way. But I do believe that he actually disappeared at the consulate. And somehow the Saudis, since the Turks have gone into the consulate and searched, the Saudis have made that body disappear. Now, the Turks allowed the Saudis allowed the Turks to search the consulate. That means that they are pretty confident that whatever evidence there is has been essentially made to disappear. Otherwise, they would have never allowed the Turks to go into the consulate. So this notion of that he was dismembered means that you dismember a body, there's going to be a lot of blood there. I mean, this is not a joke. And I doubt whether there was any evidence that the probably the Saudis did a pretty good job of cleaning it up. But look, this is all speculation, unfortunately, and I think we can be fairly certain that Mr. Khashoggi is no longer alive. But there are other inconsistencies. I mean, his fiancée had a piece in the New York Times yesterday in which she claimed that she had a birthday party for him this past weekend. And I've heard that his actual birthday is in January, or if you use the Islamic calendar, in March. So there's too much funny things going on here. I'm not questioning that he's dead. I think he's dead. But whether or not the Saudis now will ever admit to it is another question. And it is also possible that MBS, the Crown Prince, has to play hardball because his position may be at stake at the moment. But I'm not the Saudi expert, so I would not want to speculate more than that.
And again, I'm speaking with Henri Barkey, who's Professor of International Relations at Lehigh University and a Senior Fellow in Middle East Studies at the Council on Foreign Relations. He served as a member of the United States State Department's policy planning staff, working primarily on the Middle East, the Eastern Mediterranean, and intelligence, and has authored and co-authored edited five books, among them Turkey's Kurdish Question with Graham Fuller and Reluctant Neighbor, Turkey's Role in the Middle East. Well, the President Trump said today that he spoke by phone with Crown Prince Mohammed bin Salman and that the Crown Prince totally denied any knowledge. And Trump went on to say, he told me that he'd already started and will rapidly expand a full and complete investigation into this matter. Answers will be forthcoming shortly. So the only people that are sort of talking about an investigation and that it's not a clear-cut case seem to be President Trump and the Saudis. I mean, most people, don't you think, Henri, have accepted the fact that, and you indeed just said that it looks like he was murdered in the Saudi consulate in Istanbul.
I said he died. I mean, he may have been murdered or he may have had a heart attack.
Right.
I don't know.
Right, or he may have been, they may have tried to sedate him, and that was apparently what a lot of people thought. They were going to sedate him and take him back to Saudi Arabia.
Right, it's possible that the people who interrogated him were not very professional, they were amateurs. I don't know, and none of us know this.
Right, but if it's not the way that we've been told, that it was this gruesome, horrible thing, and they chopped up the body and shipped the parts out, then don't the Saudis have to come up with the body?
That's a very good question. I mean, but if they are denying that they had anything to do with his death, they don't have to show a body, right? It's for others who claim that he was killed to show that there was a body. Basically, that will be their argument, right? If they are very, very, very confident that there is absolutely no evidence that anybody can find that he was killed. And actually, think about it. Something occurred to me. The Saudis allowed the Turks to search the premises. For argument's sake, postulate the following, that the Saudis are 1,000% sure that the Turks would not be able to find any evidence, right? Then, paradoxically, we can argue that the Saudis set a trap for the Turks, right? Because now the Turks have to say, we have evidence, because they've been saying we have evidence that he got killed. Now they have to show the evidence. and if the Turks don't cannot show the evidence, they are going to end up looking pretty poorly. And the Saudis are going to make sure to play that up.
So that could explain why Trump seems pretty confident that he's going to be able to bury this.
Right. And then what the Saudis are doing, and this is what I'm speculating. Please, you and your listeners, be kind to me on that front. It is possible that if the Saudis set this trap for the Turks, right? Because initially, remember, yesterday they said, there were these rumors that they were going to admit to the fact that they killed them, etc. The Turks couldn't find the evidence, and MBS is ready to double up and say, we have nothing to do with it. And now he has the President of the United States, who obviously is freelancing on this. I mean, I don't think the President of the United States is necessarily consulting with people on this issue. But nonetheless, he's doubling down, backing the Saudis on this. So this is going to be an interesting game.
But stay
tuned to it.
Yeah, but why do you think people like Senator Lindsey Graham and Bob Corker and Marco Rubio, all Republican senators on the Foreign Relations Committee, why are they all so confident that the Turks' version of the story is the right one, that he was murdered and dismembered in that consulate? In fact, Lindsey Graham went further and said that MBS has got to go.
Right. So my guess is that our intelligence agencies are probably telling U.S. government and U.S. senators that they are fairly confident that Khashoggi died at the consulate, whatever the circumstances, that he died at the consulate. And that's what these three senators are basing their judgments on. But that doesn't undermine, shall we say, my proposition that MBS and maybe Trump, knowingly or unknowingly, have set a trap for the Turks to essentially show the evidence. And if the Turks can't show any evidence after all the stuff that they leaked, that it will be, the egg will be on the Turkish face, actually.
This is potentially
very interesting. And then is United States intelligence going to come out and say, no, we actually agree with the Turks, he was killed in the consulate? I doubt it.
Well, just in closing, Henri Bakke, the Secretary of State is having a very friendly visit in Saudi Arabia as we speak, but he's heading to Turkey on Wednesday. What do you think is going on there? Is he the intermediary between the three, between Trump,
yes,
MBS,
yes,
and Erdogan?
Yes.
And what do you think he's going to
achieve?
What's he going to achieve?
Well, I mean, at this stage, MBS has put the monkey wrench in the workings of this, so I don't know what the deal would be. My initial assumption was it would be an admission on the part of Saudis that something went wrong during the interrogation, and that therefore they regret Mr. Khashoggi's demise. Turks will say we accept this explanation, and we hope that Mr. Khashoggi's relatives will be compensated and stuff like that. And once you say this stuff, the Turks will climb down from their position, and of course the Saudis will have to give the Turks something, and the United States will praise Erdogan for his statesmanship and how he behaved, etc. And what Erdogan wants from the United States is political brownie points, and that's it. And that's how you close the deal. But that's what I thought Pompeo was going to do. But now MBS has upped the ante, so I don't know.
Well, Henri Bakke, I thank you very much for joining us here today.
Thank you. Thank you.
And again, I've been speaking with Henri Bakke. He's a professor of international relations at Lehigh University and a senior fellow in Middle East Studies at the Council on Foreign Relations. He served as a member of the United States State Department's policy planning staff, working primarily on the Middle East, the Eastern Mediterranean, and intelligence. And he's authored, co-authored, and edited five books, among them Turkey's Kurdish Question with Graham Fuller and Reluctant Neighbor, Turkey's Role in the Middle East. Welcome back. I'm Ian Masters, and this is Background Briefing, available 24/7 at backgroundbriefing.org. And joining us now is Aaron Stein, who's a resident senior fellow at the Atlantic Council's Rafiq Hariri Center for the Middle East, whose research interests include U.S.-Turkey relations, Turkish foreign policy, the Syrian conflict, nonproliferation, and the Iranian nuclear program. And he previously worked as a consultant for the International Crisis Group. Welcome to Background Briefing, Aaron Stein.
Thank you very much for having me.
So what do you make of the trip Secretary of State Pompeo's? He's in Saudi Arabia, he's going to Turkey on Wednesday. Seems like President Trump himself is kind of orchestrating this situation, which appears in many ways to be a cover-up. What do you make of the president's role in almost prompting the Saudis to talk about rogue actors and that this is something that MBS, Mohammed bin Salman, is not responsible for?
Yeah, it's been interesting. You know, I think it's put the administration in a difficult position because the Saudis have been, you know, at least for this administration, such a close ally. And the two sides, the U.S. And the Kingdom of Saudi Arabia, particularly under Mohammed bin Salman and the Trump administration, are working very closely together. And so for this to happen, you know, it forces a decision or at least uncomfortable discussions about the entirety of the U.S.-Saudi relationship. And I think the Trump administration would rather this go away so that they can try and manage the crisis and the fallout and the outrage over the killing of Jamal Khashoggi and try and get back to business as usual, which is to keep robust ties with what they view as a close ally.
But that's not shared with Republican senators, particularly prominent ones in foreign relations, like Senator Lindsey Graham and Marco Rubio and Bob Corker. Senator Graham said today that MBS has to go.
Yeah, I mean, you're clearly seeing a divergence. You know, when the Trump administration seems to be looking, again, for an out clause here that would give the Saudis some room to wiggle out from underneath this, I mean, I think the question is, with so much in American politics, is will Senate Republicans break from a Republican president if it eventually gets to that point? And you can think of any number of ways that the Senate could force the executive's hand, you know, either by making life more difficult for the export of arms or even, you know, moving legislation through that would place sanctions on Saudi Arabia and then sending it to the president's desk to force him to choose.
Well, I think it's pretty clear, isn't it, Aaron, that the Washington establishment, State Department, Pentagon, CIA, they preferred the original crown prince when MBS was the deputy crown prince, Mohammed bin Nayef. And is it possible that they could have enough pressure? That seems like for the Saudis, that might be the easiest way out, just to simply retire this young, impetuous leader, although my understanding is he's managed to pretty much corral the three militaries, the intelligence services. He's intimidated all the other princes. In many ways, he's running a reign of terror, so he may not be that easy to dislodge.
Yeah, I mean that's a good question. I don't think the U.S. will have much of a role here other than trying to contain the fallout, you know, because again, you know, Saudi is important to the U.S., obviously, because of energy exports and the oil trade, but also because of guaranteed access to, say, Saudi air bases or airspace for any number of, you know, potential contingencies that the Pentagon likes to think about. You know, and so losing this would make life more complicated for people who think all day about the Middle East. In terms of Saudi politics, you know, I think it's clear that bin Salman is consolidating his power. He's made a number of missteps, clearly the war in Yemen, and then, you know, by all accounts, murdering and perhaps even dismembering a rather prominent Saudi himself, albeit one that's now lived in self-imposed exile, could make life more difficult with them. And I think that's why you're seeing such damage control. They're looking for a way out, too, and, you know, welcomed almost, you know, the visit of Secretary Pompeo by putting out, you know, rather nice photographs that seem to suggest that the two men were laughing and smiling and therefore trying to give off this idea that things were very much business as usual.
And again, I'm speaking with Aaron Stein, who's a resident senior fellow at the Atlantic Council's Rafiq Hariri Center for the Middle East, whose research interests include U.S.-Turkey relations, Turkish foreign policy, and the Syria conflict, nonproliferation. And he previously worked as a consultant for the International Crisis Group. So let's turn then to what's going on with President Erdogan. Do you think he's angling for a payoff, or do you think, in other words, from the Saudis, or do you think he's got the evidence, which they've been leaking for the last week and suggesting they have it, or could they be bluffing?
I think when, you know, particularly certain Turkish news outlets are the sole source of information, you have to be skeptical of that. But sort of the sustained drip of leaks from the Turkish government, the hyper-specificity of the leaks, and seemingly corroborating reports from other officials would lead me to believe that the Turks are, have the goods here. It's not beyond the realm of possibility that the host governments electronically monitor, foreign diplomatic buildings in those countries, and so that the Turks would have some sort of ability to record or monitor Saudi discussions inside their own consulate, so long as they're not in protected rooms or a secured facility. And so I think they have it. Do I think Erdogan's angling for a payoff? I tend to view it rather benignly. You know, the Saudis did something brazen and brutal inside of Turkey. They clearly violated Turkish sovereignty and all sorts of, conventions on diplomatic facilities. But the Turks are, and the Turks are rightly upset about that. But Saudi Arabia, despite antagonisms between the two governments and relatively frigid relations between bin Salman and Erdogan, are nevertheless sort of an important symbol in the Muslim world. And Erdogan going sort of rhetorically nuclear on the Saudis could be politically difficult for him, and therefore he has preferred to increase the pressure on them via the media and via these leaks. I think he would ideally like President Trump to take a hard line against this. Against the Saudis, but I'm not sure he's going to get his wish.
But do you think that this could be an opportunity for Erdogan to broker some kind of settlement over Qatar? Because you know that the Turks sent in a kind of tripwire military unit, because when MBS blockaded Qatar 2 weeks after President Trump's state visit, which caught everybody by surprise, I think the possibility of a full invasion was a part of the calculus, but for the presence of Turkish troops.
Yeah, I mean there are also U.S. troops in Qatar.
Right. Well, but the reports are, Aaron, that both Tillerson and Mattis were furious, and that there were reports that President Trump himself wasn't aware of the importance of this U.S. base or even of its existence. I don't know whether that's true or not, but that's been reported.
Yeah, no, I saw that too. I mean, I mean that could be something that Erdogan pursues, is trying to use this as leverage with the Saudis to try and push them towards a resolution with Qatar. I mean, I think at this point, the Turks have released so much information via leaks. Everybody's, they claim that they have an audio and in some reports a video of the killing. you know, and they've held that back. And I mean, who wants to watch that if it really exists? Who wants to listen to that again if it really exists? But I think what one of the reasons they're holding it back is that would betray sources and methods. And so there's hesitancy to reveal the extent to which they can listen to conversations inside of consulates. And they may be trying to use that for leverage behind the scenes. But again, I think that they would prefer that the U.S. is up front in this so that they can sort of hide behind the U.S. And still get a payoff. Now, the question is whether the U.S. is willing to go as far as the Turks want. If the U.S. is not as willing to go as far as the Turks want, if the Turks will try and then use this for leverage in much the way you described.
But if the Turks were to produce it, and it wouldn't necessarily be shown on CNN, but if it's true what the Turks are saying happened in that consulate, that's the kind of butchery that we expect from the Islamic State. I mean, they're only too happy to show their videos of cutting people's heads off, etc. But I think this gets down, doesn't it, if it's true, it gets down to what kind of moral position the U.S. is taking. And it seems to me that the U.S. Senate is taking a moral position, but not the president.
I think that's right. I mean, you know, Trump is being Trumpian in the way that he's handling this, in that he is falling back on tropes, you know, comparing Saudi Arabia to Brett Kavanaugh in terms of guilty, you know, presuming guilt before innocence, and is giving them every opportunity to try and wiggle out, them being the Saudis. Whether the Saudis take yes for an answer, I think, will be settled in Riyadh. Clearly, somebody's going to have to take the fall for this. And so the question is, how are they going to do this, and how do they manage their own thing? And I think we have to have a little bit of humility here, is that, you know, their internal debates are opaque and difficult to understand for outsiders, and you know, largely up to them. So we'll be reactive to how they try and resolve this. I mean, all we can say thus far is that they haven't handled this. They haven't handled this well. This was botched. This was easy to follow. You know, the rendering team or the execution squad, depending on what they intended, sort of bungled this and was easy to track. And so this isn't their shining moment. And clearly they haven't handled this well as the scandal has grown more acute and the pressure has increased.
Well, apparently there are now some intelligence reports that suggest that the Turks actually got evidence from the sewers and the drains of blood and bone, etc. Again, this stuff keeps leaking out. It does seem that the leak of the Apple Watch to explain how they had audio and video of what was going on inside of the Saudi consulate, that seemed like it was a cover effort on the part of the MIT to disguise the real source of their information, because apparently from all the technical evidence that we have, an Apple Watch simply can't do what they claim it did. What was your take on that? Do you think that was a way for the MIT to try and disguise sources and methods?
Yes, I mean, the Apple Watch sort of story. I mean, the Turks claim that this man, the Saudi man Jamal Khashoggi, you know, recorded himself, and that was the source of the audio, and uploaded either to iCloud or to the iPhone that it was tethered to. That makes no sense, and that just seems like a relatively inartful cover for how the Turks monitor the Saudi embassy, again, presuming that audio and video exists in the first place. As for, you know, getting blood and bone and DNA evidence, I've seen that reported as well. No follow-up. What we do know is today a Turkish forensic team went into the Saudi consulate in Istanbul, and in doing so, they leaked that the place had been cleaned. There was even photographs of the cleaning crew going in the front door, and that rooms had been painted, you know, sort of consistent with a country that has something to hide. And they also leaked, again, who knows if it's true, because of the speed with which it was leaked, that they had indications from this investigation that a crime was committed. They didn't tell us how they got that information, but one would presume that there was some forensic evidence that they got. Again, assuming that the leaks are accurate. I think at this point, it's all worth saying that all of the information is coming out from the Turkish side, which makes sense if this happened in Turkey. But it is all coming from the Turkish side. And so there is, again, you know, early reports, indications, leaks, this type of thing should always be, in my opinion, read with certain amounts of skepticism until officials are willing to go on the record and publicly document how and where they got the information.
Well, just in closing, the fact that Khashoggi was a reporter with the Washington Post and a journalist, and that the President Trump on many occasions has referred to the press as the enemy of the people, and he's been particularly hostile towards the Washington Post and CNN. Is it possible that MBS saw that as some kind of green light? Oh, I'm not going to get into much trouble with President Trump and the Americans because, after all, the president hates the press and particularly the Washington Post.
You know, that's an open-ended question, you know, about whether or not the Saudis thought that, you know, because of their close relationship with the Trump administration and their, you know, and President Trump's sort of well-documented disdain for the press, sort of weird disdain for the press, because he, on the one hand, he calls them enemy of the people, but on the other hand, he quite obviously wants their praise and is, I think, upset and insecure that he doesn't get it. Is that in this environment of extreme hostility, sure, you know, it could be seen as, you know, greater American willingness to tolerate such awful human rights abuses. Now, I've met Jamal Khashoggi in the past. He's a very nice and affable guy, complicated figure. You know, he's well known around the world because of his travels, his writings, his access to the previous sort of Saudi dynasty. Therefore, I think his death has particularly hit home because it's personal for a lot of people. And it will be very difficult for the spotlight, in my opinion, to turn off until there's more clarity on what happened. So the Saudis will continue to feel heat and feel pressure, you know, independent of what President Trump thinks about the media or the signals they thought they got from this administration before carrying out a targeted killing.
Well, Aaron Stein, I thank you very much for joining us.
My pleasure. Thanks a lot for having me.
Thank you. And again, I've been speaking with Aaron Stein, who is a resident senior fellow at the Atlantic Council's Rafiq Hariri Center for the Middle East, whose research interests include Turkey, U.S.-Turkey relations, Turkish foreign policy, the Syrian conflict, and nonproliferation. This has been Background Briefing. I'm Ian Masters. I'd like to thank producer Graham Fitzgibbon. This program is available for podcasting at ianmasters.com. We can contact me and scroll down the right-hand side and sign up for iTunes podcasts. And I'll be back again tomorrow with another Background Briefing. Bye for now.